intention is to sum up. I don't know that we are prepared to sum up in terms of very specific conclusions, are we? I don't think we ever set up the course in such a way. We never set up a specific kind of research or problem that would lead to a specific conclusion. I have the impression that what we really undertook to do was essentially to open out the subject. We might have taken such a thing as the frustration-aggression hypothesis and subjected that to clear examination and decided it holds or it doesn't hold or it's inadequate. Well, we might have done even worse, I think, and that is taken Lorenz very seriously and decided that this either holds or doesn't hold or is inadequate. So I think what we really set out to do made the most sense given where we were with the subject, which is essentially to start with source material without any, really with a minimum of preconceptions, and look freshly at the material. You would agree, I think, that this is essentially what we did, because by not formulating any specific questions, but by going to societies where we know there is aggression, where we know there is antagonism, and where we know, at least we did know, that the aggression and the antagonism were of a particular type that is essentially embedded in a religion, essentially really embedded in ritual. And also, I guess we assumed too, at least I certainly assumed, that really the focus for the study of aggression and antagonism in human society is not simply the sparking off of an anger or episodic violences, but something that was really so very fundamental and really sufficiently rooted in the nature of people that it would find lodging in a ritual organization. So perhaps we might say this at least was a beginning assumption, that the most important place to look wasn't something that is ritualized. And I think our assumption there was that which is ritualized is psychologically genuine to begin with, but it has a particular authenticity by virtue of the fact that people have elaborated it. They have invested it with a great deal of imaginative thought. And so this is, I think, of particular significance. And I guess this is essentially what our point of departure has been. And I think what we probably would get out of a summary . And the most important thing really for us to do is to point up really avenues, because I think this is where we are. That is, when I say avenues, I mean avenues really of further investigation, because to be consistent with our intention, which was to open up the study, I think we need to recall what is it that we have actually opened up, what does it actually suggest to us. And where could one go? Where could really one go from there? If any of you feel that there is something of a more specific nature that we have come across that we can formulate, I think that would be fine to bring out.
Study of aggression as such, but perhaps what we've we found may have shown that aggression is either too small or too great a force to be isolated and studied itself. Because what we've seen, I think, are a lot of motifs that people use in order to give their life meaning. And perhaps living is the real aggression, and it may be too general or too obscure to really say that we've studied something about aggression.
You mean our study was more general than that?
I know it was more specific. No, it was more specific.
More specific.
Much more specific.
Cynthia?
I'm thinking.
Gotta take your time.
Okay.
Lisa?
Can I postulate a little
machine?
But,
I think about an inanimate box moving.
Now, how about another idea of aggression, of overt and covert aggression, and what we perhaps have tried to do is study the more overt types, but that there may be some kind of mean among all primitive peoples. Of aggression that is fundamental to their lives, and that it's just what maybe we should think about is what makes it take such an overt form. I mean, the difference between something like the Plains Indians and the Lepchits, or something primarily apparent difference, but then certain things come up in each area that might suggest that what was previously thought isn't quite the case. It's kind of general.
Can you speak of corporate aggression and you mean mentally or psychologically?
Mm-hmm. Maybe some.
I mean, overt aggression, I take it you mean, Harry, that in, say, Plains Indian, which was our major example, that aggressiveness and antagonism are established as the really fundamental principles mm-hmm. by which people deal with the major issues, and that they see the way of contending with death. For example, is through an aggressive measure. Hmm? This is what you mean by aggression. It becomes a focal force, and they are organized around that, becomes a central motif.
Right.
Then you're implying then that in among the Aylorese and among the Lepchers, the aggression is there on the assumption that if they are human, there is an aggression,
mm-hmm.
but that it takes a, it's really. Is a, what you say takes a subordinate form, or
yeah, and something. Also, it might have to do with what you might call the primary gestalt of man, the first way of looking at the world, the first attempt to give meaning to life, and how that. How that will influence like the overt signs of the culture, the way that the culture is transforms itself into reality, the metaphor of the culture, you should phrase.
We almost make it sound as if that no longer exists, though.
What?
You said the early.
Well, yeah, but it's not. I mean, it's hard to. I think the thing that's so interesting about primitive people is that you think that you've seen them somewhere in the you know, in code beginnings of their existence,
mm-hmm.
you know, close to that, and that what you're seeing is like, if you take primitive man as kind of an example of all men,
mm-hmm.
you know, the beginning, which you think is that the first ways of figuring out things have come, that you may be able to see that actually in practice when you study primitive man. And it's, of course it's in existence now, but now it's when civilizations have arisen, there's certain things that become programmed into the culture and that you can study as soon as the culture becomes literate, I guess. And a lot of it's done for you. I mean, now we don't have to, there's a whole, I mean, people today, you know, in like our society, there's all these, there are books and references and stories and just a whole way of like knowing your orientation without, you know, and it's very easy for you. You know, you don't have to make a, you know, maybe a philosopher once in a century will come, you know, and say that it's different. But primitive people, I think, seem to be right there at the, you know, the cataclysmic beginning, the real.
What can we make? Say we have two kinds of societies, and we'll follow your notion about overt and covert aggression. And we'll grant that, say, the Plains Indians' aggression that is overt, if you gal is aggression, overt, Ashanti, overt, the Polynesia, of course, is very strikingly of this nature, and Kwakiutl is very strikingly of that nature. And then we have some cultures on the other side, certainly Lepcha is an outstanding example. Zuni is also, I think, isn't it?
How about, well, Navajo?
Well,
also,
even though you did bring out, you know, aggression, nevertheless, it, when you think of Zuni and as part of the American Indian, and as you see them on the southern border of the Plains Indians, they do stand out in a strikingly different way. Now, do any of you have a feeling that one is on to something by this kind of separation, or is it, think all we can, in other words, what can we say about this distinction?
Well,
what does it seem to imply?
How about just to undercut that? Why did we begin to study aggression in the first place? What did we hope to find, you know, to gain by a study like that? I mean, other than having, you know, a course that says...
Other than having a course, that's a very good question, why we have a course. Well, we might as well say something about it. Actually, its subject is not that well understood. One, there is a very powerful theoretical position that aggression is somehow something extraordinary, or something pathological, or some kind of a tendency of man that must be severely controlled, or eliminated. But that aggression is something you worry about, and so I think we want really to look at that. And I don't know that we came out with any support for the idea that aggression as such, or antagonism as such, is something that one would really worry about.
Mm-hmm.
Now, related to this idea is, it seems to me, that the basic theory of aggression, there are two basic theories of aggression. One coming from ethology is the sort of the pessimistic view that while animals having reliable instincts are able to control their aggressions and do not destroy themselves, and the other, that something has gone wrong with mankind, and that aggression gets out of hand, man really lacks the reliable instinct. Also growing out of ethological theory was the idea that ritual, since something called ritual is found in the animal world, that man can learn to ritualize aggression. Well, these are ideas which one would really felt one had to examine. Then, of course, there is the frustration-aggression hypothesis coming out of psychoanalytic theory, which develops a theory to explain why it is that aggression is really a human response to a trouble.
Yeah.
In other words, if you eliminated frustrations or you managed frustrations in some other way, people would really not be aggressive at all. In other words, almost wherever one looks, wherever one turns rather to the theoretical world, we come upon aggression as a kind of a problem. The question is, how do you control it?
Right.
How do you channel it? Ritual is a way of channeling it.
Yeah,
now, there have been...
I was just going to say that the presupposition is that there's either some kind of cultural or personal lack or some kind of threat. It's usually based on one of those two hypotheses.
Yes, that's right. There is a threat. Now, there are other theories, of course, which are becoming prominent now, which are beginning to visualize aggression in a different way, and that is seeing aggression as a way enhancing group identity and so on. But in any case, my reason for offering the course on aggression was essentially the hope that if one could approach the subject of aggression without visualizing as a problem in social pathology, or without even visualizing it as a problem, but simply visualizing it as a human expression, which is constant in one form or another in every society, and simply explore it, that we would be on a more whole, that we would end up, seems to me, with a more wholesome view of what it actually is. As an anthropologist, of course, my interest is in trying to understand the nature of culture, and it's of course in anthropology you want to understand the nature of culture. And this war, the patterning of culture through postulating antagonistic elements, male, female, for example, life, death. Not to mention what seemed to be coming out all along is a human concern with vitality. So these things to me are part of what culture is built upon. One can really postulate. Well, I suppose we could put it this way. We had a discussion of this some time back, which is that anthropology has been living in a dream world of equilibrium theory, that every culture is designed essentially to relieve tension. The tensions sort of arise, unfortunately, as a result of life, and the function of a culture is to find a way of reducing the tensions so that all relationships end up in a kind of a stable way. And I wouldn't say this theory makes no sense at all, but this has been somehow... It's a theory that has held the field almost exclusively for almost as long as anthropology has been a scientific discipline. And it would seem that if one were to approach cultures from the point of view of focusing on antagonisms and aggression, we might get a different slant on what culture really is. And then we need to ask ourselves to what extent we have succeeded in that. So anyway, this is my justification for, just as when I wrote the book on Polynesia, it was a book starting with a study of status rivalry, which is an aggressive idea. It really was an attempt to formulate an overall view of culture, really from a point of view almost antithetical to that equilibrium tension reduction thing. But methodologically, this always makes sense that if you're going to, if you want, you always have to start something, you have to foment a new approach. And the easiest way to foment a new approach is to take an opposing direction. And so perhaps it seems to me that this is what we really, it seems to me, what we really were getting at. And I think we want to talk then to the question as to what sort of new light actually shed on culture. It seems to me this more than anything else has to be our principal concern, because unless we understand what a culture really is, which means understanding the nature of cultural meanings, what the drives are, and so on, it seems to me we understand nothing at all. And the problem has always seemed to me, it's not that we have to worry about a controlling aggression. Because I think I can understand the problem of trying to control war, which is not the same thing as controlling aggression. It's a serious error to how to keep ourselves from blowing ourselves up in a nuclear way from controlling aggression. We could work out any number of ways of safeguarding our lives from a terrible war. But when people talk about how do we go about controlling aggression, they really have to know what a culture is and what the role of aggression is in it. Because they might as well say, we want to do away with human vigor. Because somebody has decided that a vigorous person is an unpleasant person. And you really have to know what is the role of vigor in the psychology of the human being. Well, right, it seems to me, essentially where what we have accomplished is the ability to see in every instance the aggression not as pathological. Maybe that's simplifying the thing, and this is something we know that we need to talk about.
Can I ask a corollary question? Is anthropology moving away from the realm of the scientific more into the one kind of the realm of literary? Because because as like you said, more. There's less and less actual field work, in which you have to do with what you're dealing with now is texts, and the result or the method of dealing with them is interpretive, I guess you could say it's a different thing though.
Antagonism is a build-up, is an opposition.
To the agon, the struggle.
Yeah.
I got
power to the struggle.
that's a very good definition. That's the one we have been using. Aggress. To attack. To start a quarrel or attack. Aggression. See aggress. An unprovoked attack or invasion. Practice a habit of being aggressive. All right, aggressive. Aggressing or inclined to aggress. Starting fights or quarrels. Then comes full of enterprise and initiative.
Hmm.
Bold and active pushing. It also implies a bold and energetic pursuit of one's ends, connoting in derogatory usage a ruthless desire to dominate, and in a favorable sense, enterprise, initiative, etc. So it involves a notion of an attack and a notion of self-assertion.
Well, were the other theories you mentioned dealing with aggression as assertiveness, or were they dealing with it as quarreling?
They were dealing with it in the derogatory sense, essentially. That is, the assumptions ordinarily go about your own business. You would not be hostile to anyone. Nobody would be an enemy. But if you are thwarted, then you turn hostile.
Mm-hmm.
You attack. And there's a sense of proportion in frustration, aggression. That is, the greater the degree of frustration, the greater the degree of hostility. In other words, aggressiveness is associated, essentially, with hostility. But we have been employing, I think, the concept of aggression really, obviously, in both senses, in the sense of initiative, self-assertion, vitality, but also that, see, there must be a relativism. There is, in fact, a relativism in self-assertiveness. And that is, how do you measure your own vitality or else your own self-assertiveness unless you can postulate somebody else who is beneath you and who is a victim? The notion of a victim is really implicit in this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in systems which we have admired, victim and aggressor play a kind of a balanced role. This is especially true in the Plains Indian. They were sufficiently well balanced, so nobody won all of the victories. As a matter of fact, when you have a system on the Plains Indians where, let's say, America, white America, won all of the victory, this was utterly destructive. This is what led to the utter demoralization of the people. Whereas, well, film Dead Birds, Kwak Yewon, in fact, all ritualized aggressions seem to be based, not necessarily, it seems, seemingly upon a theory of balance, they didn't have to worry about because nature took care of that. They were all living within the same realm. They were bound to be balanced, more or less. It may be what has troubled us in the contemporary world is that the balances get to be completely out of whack. And when there is really an acute misbalance, then I think aggression begins to take a very different form. And I think we got into that to some degree when we considered the ghost dance among the Plains Indians. And when we, did we get into the peyote cult? We didn't really go that far, but the peyote cult simply brings the Indians down still another step. In other words, when the aggressiveness is really out of balance, the effect is essentially simply crushing. And so we have been dealing with balance. But there it seems to me we're up against what is a purely contemporary, not entirely contemporary phenomenon, but especially contemporary phenomenon, because it's something like equivalent to an ecological imbalance. That is, our ability to destroy the physical environment is an example, really, of some loss of balance, because nature breaks through balances. And the contemporary world has really posed the problem for lots of people of what do you do to restore a balance which is preponderantly against you. Something I think maybe, see, perhaps the frustration aggression hypothesis we might have to make some meaning when we get into that kind of a situation, because then one can really begin to visualize another kind of frustration. See, what has been difficult with the whole frustration aggression hypothesis anyway, that the concept of frustration is so very vague. What is frustrating? See, everything is frustrating. If you decide you'd rather fly, but you can't fly, so that's a frustration. If you decide you'd like to run a mile in, you know, in 3 minutes, and you can't do it, that's a frustration. So it's extremely vague, but there must be very palpable levels of frustration when the balances are very much upset.
It also has to do with your imagination, I think, because it's how far you can grasp with your mind that determines what limit will frustrate you.
Do you know anything about Balinese dance? Because I heard it mentioned somewhere that the type of dancing where everything is very fluttery and shaking is a result of like frustration of very young kids, and it's an expression, you know, this frustration aggression hypothesis, you know, like the babies are frustrated so much that, you know, that's how they learn to do this kind of dance, and then after a certain age or after puberty, you know, they don't dance, they do other things. I'm really not sure, but it's
Yes, Mies' work on Bali stresses that fact. The Balinese mothers, according to me, and she has very good evidence for it, obviously for us, a very strange way of treating their children. That is, the mother does what she can to excite the child. And when the child is responsive, the mother turns her face away and ignores it. And the child is left with its responsiveness non-registering. And this certainly is a very fine statement, obviously, of a frustration, and it has got to be channeled. But I think, to my mind, what is problematic about this kind of Balinese study is that it starts with a child-rearing situation and postulates the quality of the dance, postulates the quality of their mythology, witches, threatening females, all of them. It postulates them as growing out of this childhood situation. I consider this a very incomplete kind of study. Full study would be one in which one had some kind of an understanding of the history of Balinese culture and had more of an understanding of the religious character of Balinese ritual. I don't see how you can go deal with something psychologically until you really know what its cultural content really is. But this is really one of the very interesting statements of the frustration aggression hypothesis. We didn't go into this because the only example we had of child rearing would be Ayla Rees. Now, had we accepted the Ayla Rees material at face value, we would have had an illustration of the way in which an inconsistent kind of parental care, because I think this is essentially characteristic of the Ayla Rees. Inconsistency interrupts the clear development of self-assertiveness. In other words, the self-assertiveness of the individual, a cardinal executive ability, simply interfered with because there was simply no constant against which the child could develop. The mother was one way one day, another way another day, and so on. All of the inconsistency. There's a great deal of teasing of children, and so on. When the cultures in the Plains Indians and in Kwakiutl and I think in Polynesia, one does see a very consistent development of concepts of self-assertion, and a very consistent development of patterns of aggression, a pattern of antagonism. The whole concept of self-assertiveness and patterns is very clearly articulated as a single imagery for it, for the guidelines are very clear. I think what we were uncertain about in the case of the Ayla Rees is not so much that there was an uncertainty and a lack of clarity, but as to the to its source, because something about the history of the Ayla Rees had not really been brought out. They were a people who had been brought into contact and moved with a people of a higher civilization, a more advanced culture. They had been moved relatively recently, and we weren't entirely clear as to where to put, not a matter of putting the blame, but where to place the emphasis, whether upon an unfortunate history or an unfortunate child rearing. Maybe some kind of a combination of both.
Has anyone ever put forth a theory? It's not just one of nomadism versus settled existence per se, but you know, that kind of, well, maybe that's what I mean, not just the environmental determinism, which is a factor, but I've been noticing, just looking at the Comanches again and rereading some of Veblen's stuff, the extent to which the relative movement of people affects, you know, the kind of things that, the kinds of aggressive activities. So Veblen's attacks quite bitterly and not at all wrongly, like the concepts of conspicuous consumption and conspicuous waste. And I've kind of balanced that opinion as one of not so much a difference in kind as a matter of difference in form. And I used environmental settings, really, to illustrate why. He even goes through social evolutionary stages of, what is it, naive seizure and capture, that's what he calls it. And the different kinds of things that were, which lent status to a person, be it women, land, and slaves, and then it moves on as things settle. You know, became, we had this money orientation. And I felt that, it's been said before that there are no more frontiers, but it's a little different than that. The fact that it was no longer viable to get status by virtue of physical means, it wasn't as easy to go grasp those kinds of things, and therefore it became more inwardly motivated, and became, instead of physical, more cerebral kind of aggression, and just fought with, you know, paper money and mental tricks and that kind of thing. So,
in other words, you're talking about you're talking about contemporary society.
No, well, I think it kind of holds, no, because he's not. He's showing a historical thing. It's not just modern society showing that over the years and centuries and eons, this has developed from a barbaric state to, well, he calls a barbaric state to the industrial state. And I'm saying, well, it's not just money, but the aims are still the same. That of self-aggrandizement. The means of necessity had to change.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Could you talk to that from the point of view of Zuni, Lisa?
I understand what you say, but the main thing that I picked up from what you said was that there's been a transfer from physical aggression to cerebral. Well, from the point of view of Zuni, I think there's a lot of cerebral aggression, and probably more of that than... And the kind of measuring that goes on is not physical measuring, it's on against it, more of an internal standard, or other people's standards, but it's not physical. But maybe you would... Maybe it's not just an industrial state that works for, maybe it's...
Oh, I see. No, I wasn't... Yeah, okay.
Maybe I didn't understand.
Well, I was just using the wound to context that he presented one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know what kind of technologies he used, but for his thing, you know, the primitive man, the most sophisticated type thing, it was kind of... There's a sense of cultural imperialism, unquestionably, in his attitude. But using his word, I mean, that's what it lends itself to. There isn't that much to take physically, it's not that challenging. So you have to put it on a different kind of level.
Speak up. I hear what you're saying.
Oh,
you have to speak up if you're going to be recorded anyway.
Well,
even if you're not going to be recorded, I'd like to hear what you're saying. When you talk about, if I understand you, talk about... physical aggression to, you know, like more like aggression that is on your head, in people's heads, essentially.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, at least among the IFO gal, I think this is very true. I think there's a high level of aggression that goes on, a high level of aggression that is constantly maintained.
Physically or...
But most of it, like, you know, 95% of it is, takes expression in forms other than... physical aggression.
Isn't that kind of what we said about most cultures?
Yes.
That we then transform the aggression from, you know, physical to other cosmic
things. And what would that mean, transforming it from physical to what?
To more cosmic.
Yes. Of course, one interesting thing for us to give thought to is really the differentiation of a culture, that is a social differentiation of a culture, in terms of aggression. For example, to mention, say, well, take the Plains Indians. Plains Indians are an example by which we're talking about the men, leaving the women out of this, but in which... every young male should really be a warrior, with few exceptions. And a man who has passed through the warrior stage, becoming an old man, now becomes a representative of peace. Well, this is a type of social diversification in which you set up two foci. One, the energetic young men who are all engaged and battling along the lines of aggression and antagonism. and are graded according to their abilities in this. Then a group of old men who are out of it, and they represent the pacific, the non-aggressive element. Well, there is nothing very problematic about this kind of situation because there are few exceptions among the men, and whoever is not aggressive has won honors by once having been a warrior. When you move to Polynesia into a rank-ordered society, you then discover that the realm of a really aggressive behavior is really that of the nobility. An entire group of people, lower rank people, are moved out of this realm of aggression. In a sense, they are feminized because the female, I mean, they are put in the same category.
Being inert.
Of being relatively inert. Now, and I think in Polynesia there are various forms of diversification. One is a large segment of the population, serfs, landless commoners, for whom aggressiveness is deadly. Now, they may be called upon from time to time to be warriors, but they take no initiative. In other words, they are condemned to an inertness. Then there are people who have become craftsmen. If you remember, Mangaia was an example of a society where the craftsman was regarded as relatively immune from war. Well, this doesn't mean that he was forbidden to be aggressive, but he could find a way out. He was no longer held to the same standards. Certain classes of priests were held to the standards. Now, we didn't really get into this particular question. I don't exactly know what we want to say about it, but I think we have been dealing essentially with relatively simple propositions of aggressiveness. But as soon as you get a diversified society with a notion of, on the one hand, inert, which is not difficult for us to understand, but another is that you acquire some notion of worth through some other means. In other words, the inert simply have no worthiness to them at all. But a priest in Polynesia, a tohunga, a craftsman, a skilled individual, I don't know that we're dealing there with a covert kind of aggression. We're dealing with a certain kind of an initiative, it is true. But it obviously postulates a very different style of life. Now, this is true in all the developing civilizations, this kind of diversification. If we had gone into a study, let us say, of the Aztec, there too we would find that the warriors represented the central source. But since Aztec had an enormous population, there were all sorts of people whose lives and so on were outside of this great expression. What constitutes a genuine kind of vitality. So there is obviously a historical process at work in which one can see the differentiation of a population along the lines of antagonism, aggressiveness, and self-assertiveness until we reach our own society when where again we have aggression, antagonism, these become practically specialized occupations.
Well, yeah, but you know, I think we're making a mistake of equating aggression with, as it were, state politics, or just limiting it to the to the art of war. I don't think that you mean to say that the craftsman isn't necessarily an aggressive person. He's just isn't taking part in statecraft. Or the national pastime of the kings, whatever. they can certainly be an aggressive guy. And we're talking about aggression in general, not just warfare.
Yeah. Well, I suppose we have to differentiate two things now. One is aggressiveness as a social role. And the other, I suppose, is personal aggressiveness. I think the examples we have given thus far, that is the inert serf can be as aggressive as all hell in his family.
Right.
And we're not dealing with that because it's just too complicated. But as in a society where those who are able to assert themselves to achieve high position through demonstrations of valor, through the ability to overcome others, through the ability, constant ability to arise, there we have a differentiation. In other words, the differentiation is along these lines. Every human being, if he's lucky, has at least a narrow scope in which his nature can express itself, so that the lowest has got at least a family where he can carry on.
Beat his wife and children, or whatever. Huh? He can beat his wife and children, or whatever.
He can
whatever.
Beat his wife and children. That's right. Or he can be a menace in his neighborhood. But he's on a very little stage, and in places like Polynesia, so he undoubtedly is able to occupy a very small place on a small stage. Whereas the Ariki there and the warriors, they are the ones for whom aggression and antagonism registers on a very broad scale. So socially, those are the people we're concerned with. In other words, the problem we are dealing with is the way in which, for some people, a position of aggressiveness, a position of antagonism, is finally reduced to a very, very small scale action. Whatever is reduced to a small scale action, I would say, already has correspondingly low status, because all societies measure status by the scope of your action. So, this is something we have not explored, the nature of this differentiation of a social role and its significance. This must bear on what you've said, doesn't it? Well, we're trying to understand the way in which an overt aggression can be replaced by something more cerebral. And the suggestion is that it could be replaced by something more cerebral following a kind of a process of social differentiation.
Change from a nomadic life to a sedentary life, you have a more sophisticated technology. So it's a very integrated kind of thing. It's difficult for me to separate which was first the technological thing or the social modification.
Yeah. What do you think, in the light of Babylon, what is then the relationship between industrialization and aggression?
Oh, God. I guess very simply, from the kind of things he implies, it eclipses man's superiority physically. He didn't surpass that way. And even though he's created the machine can outdo him in so many things. He has to find another area to exert his superiority or to attempt to. And he does this by means of conspicuous consumption and waste and display. And he even uses education very nicely. Living a very, or higher education anyway, as being conspicuous waste. As a matter of fact, because it's non-utilitarian, and he felt that
it's got prestige.
Yeah, precisely because they teach dead languages, as he puts it, and concentrate on the royal families of history without necessarily going into those historical trends, which most, it's in a way kind of Marxian, what affects the masses of people. Blunts the effect of any kind of revolutionary activity, that kind of concentration. And it also shows something else, too, that, and he never really points this out, but in any kind of elite group, really, there's, I think we discussed this freshman year, 2006, but there was always something that the elite, the restrictions, that's what it was, on the elite group, that they always have to be able to be without something, or there's certain things that they can't do. And I think more importantly that those are the kinds of things which are somehow crucial to the society, which everyone else does, but they can't participate, like labor, for example. And the whole work ethic, but in this country, whatever the elite group is, because there's the military elite and the jet city and that kind of thing. But their necessary output is relatively minimal, or the more oblique nature in terms of affecting people's lives. They've kind of transcended something very vital to that particular organization.
Lisa, what could you add from the point of view of a general nature about aggression from the point of view of the Zoom? What would be your main conclusion?
Well, let's see. Well, something I just thought of when you were saying that rank, that someone of a higher rank has a broader stage for aggression. I was thinking that ritual and mythology also are a way of broadening the stage for aggression. They broaden it even further. So that if you can deal with the aggressive aspects of life, including the way you get your food, everything is sort of assertive, then seeing it through mythology and ritual is as a way of expanding, of giving yourself a broader stage. And in Zuni, everyone has about equal amount. There are people on, it's sort of like the planes, in that people are on an equal level. Everyone can criticize everyone else.
Yes. I think that is certainly really very important. In other words, a secularization of a society simply accentuates whatever social differentiation can occur is accentuated really by a secularization, because it leaves a group of people fairly high and dry. Now, apropos of that, I think one of the curious developments in Polynesia, well, it's not really that curious, is that when the lower groups, commoners, the lower commoners became sort of metaphorically inert, their ritual role was also correspondingly reduced. Because one of the characteristic developments of such societies is that the upper classes begin to dominate ritual, and that the lower ranks are given a reduced position in ritual. So again, it seems to be part of the same process. In other words, Zuni is really utterly democratized ritual, democratized. The developing aristocracies are not, and so they narrow the stage. Why don't we take up your Eskimo, Harry, and go back to a notion of...
Can we read it?
Well, how long is it?
It's only 5 or 6 pages.
Okay.